The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and today on The Mark Steiner Show, join us for another one of our Urbanite Radio stories. This week, we'll talk about creativity, genius, and innovative solutions for social problems with inventor Saul Griffith. When Griffith was supposed to be working on his PhD at MIT, he spent his spare time trying to solve a pressing public health problem, finding a cheap way to manufacture eyeglasses for the between 500 million to 1 billion people worldwide who need glasses but can't afford them. The result was a revolutionary new machine that's similar to any desktop printer, except that what it prints is eyeglass lenses for a cost of only 40 cents a piece. He was awarded a prestigious MacArthur Genius Grant in 2007 for all that work. He's since worked on diverse projects like electronic ink, which powers electronic readers like the Kindle, and streets paved with solar panels, and much more. And we'll speak with him about why he doesn't believe in genius, what he's working on now, and how he found out that technology alone can't solve our social problems. You can read excerpts from my interview with Griffith at www.urbanitebaltimore.com. And here's our conversation with Saul Griffith. So, Saul Griffith, it's great to have you on with us. And one of the things I was thinking about is that it's remarkable to me how things change as we get into them. You created this lens printer that brought a lot of attention to you, that would kind of help make glasses for people in the poor nations in the developing world. You can describe that a bit as you answer this, but then you discovered in the process of doing that creating that lens printer that helped you get to the attention of MacArthur. They gave you a genius grant in 2007. And that you realize you were actually working on the wrong problem. So talk a bit about that, because I think that's an interesting lesson and also an incredible invention.
So that was a project I was doing when I was meant to be writing my PhD at MIT. So fortunately, you can hide these sort of side projects from the powers that be. I really got fascinated with sort of been reading and found the statistics. You know, there's somewhere between 500 million and a billion people in the world who need prescription glasses who can't afford them. And, you know, when you're young and you're naive and sort of a naturally inclined engineer, inventor type, you're like, oh, I can fix that. And so came up with this sort of novel method for manufacturing lenses. So instead of requiring a unique mold for every single prescription, there's, you know, every eye is different, so there's all these different prescriptions you need. It is one mold that can make any of those lenses, and so conceptually that's a cheaper way to make eyeglass lenses. But then, you know, and we've sort of got a little company, and we're pushing that technology forward. But as you sort of grow and learn with these technologies, and it takes a long time from an idea to become something in the market, you learn a whole lot of things, and then we sort of started to find out that really one of the major barriers to putting eyeglasses on all these people's faces cheaply is not really the cost of the lenses as much as it's the cost of getting a high-quality test of the eye so that you can prescribe the lens. And so now the project has broadened somewhat, and we're also working on devices to lower the cost of testing eyes.
Now, I've noticed that on your website that's a new area that you're that you're branching into, which I found interesting. What do you call it? Optiopia.
Optiopia is the name.
Optiopia.
And the small company, and one of the main focuses at the moment is preparing a device for human testing that will hopefully, radically lower the cost of taking your prescription. It's sort of, you know, like a a nifty version of those fancy machines that we in the West see when we go to the optometrist.
But molded so they can, no pun intended, they can be used in developing worlds where there's little technology around them.
Yeah, and so more robust so they can be used in those conditions, also designed in a way that the expensive need for the optometrist time is lowered somewhat, so you can, one trained professional can see a lot more patients a lot quicker and get the correct prescription a lot faster and bring the cost down that way.
It's interesting watching all the things that you have developed and worked on. The idea of seeing a problem and knowing you're determined that you have that it can be overcome, and it leads you to create things that sound wonderful sometimes. All of them don't work, but some of them do. But it's part of the process of saying I can make this and the world a better place in the process of what I'm doing.
Yeah, and I guess I'm pretty lucky that the world sees me doing that. But I have worked with hundreds, if not thousands, of fabulous engineers in my career to date, and it's almost just this pathological character trait of the people we call engineers and some scientists are the same, where they do what they do because they think that they can make the world better tomorrow.
Right.
And it's just awesome, and it's addictive, and I think it's sort of why I think that all of those people I know, the majority of them are happy because they wake up every morning with just this attitude that, I can improve things with my mind today. And it would be wonderful to get that to be, much more broader swath of the population waking up and thinking, hey, I can improve things today.
But it's clear though that from I think it was a TEDx conference. I'm not sure which it was. I saw you a tape of you speaking on a panel. I mean, you clearly believe that we could create an educational system that allows this kind of creative imagination to really blossom and do those kinds of things. That it's not just limited to people like Saul Griffith.
Yeah, I'm really they call the MacArthur Award the genius grant.
Right.
I'm really not a believer in genius.
Uh-huh.
I'm really a believer in that old-fashioned stuff, hard work and focus. And I also really believe that, a much larger portion of our kids have the capacity to be creative, and, not just in engineering and sciences, but in the arts. In all of the different arts, in any pursuit of life, but we're not really enabling that with the way we do education. Would be my humble opinion of the education system. It's all about standardized testing. It's not
right.
It's not about inspiration and just saying to kids, look, kids, you can grow up and make the world better. We're failing on that step.
It's interesting. This keeps coming up over and over again. And this, I don't want to make this too much of an aside, but it really hit me when I watched you speak about that on this video. And again, it comes up over and over again that if you look at education, as you said, we focus on testing all the time. But you, as a creator, as an inventor, which is really akin to being an artist in many ways.
Yeah.
And you're also deeply involved in athletics. And your physical body and being fit and being able to move and do things you want to do. And I think we forget, and people are saying, a friend says, our education system should be like three pillars, academics, the arts, and athletics. And they're all equally important if we want to create agile minds and bodies that can do things.
Yeah, and the Romans, that was their educational philosophy, right? The original, 2,000 years ago, that was sort of what they were doing with the way they designed schooling then. And it was, there was wrestling practice, and then you'd do some algebra or study the Platonic solids, and then you'd go and throw the discus for a while. And,
right.
And yeah, well, but I guess with the probably even comes down to the way we architect the schools and the physical buildings, and you know, they're just sort of little factories, and we've got to push the kids out efficiently. And I think in that drive for efficiency, we sort of lost those sort of three fundamentals.
And your growth as an inventor, as somebody who creates these things that we'll be talking about here in a couple of minutes, I mean, that wasn't just about school. That was about the environment you grew up in. That was about the way you, maybe even your family, allowed you to grow and create and play.
Yeah, I mean, at the risk of, I think we all revisit our family histories and rewrite them.
Right, we do, don't we?
But at the risk of that, I think, in some genuine sense, the reality was, you know, my father was an engineer and a professor at a university, at a college, and my mother was an artist, and both of them engendered in my sister and myself this, you know, the world is understandable, and you can create things, and you know, that's pretty much all you need to know is. And, you know, my father would be like, well, if we don't know how this machine works, let's take it apart, and there's some chance that we'll put it back together and it'll still work and we'll know more. And my mother was, you know, we can, you know, every day, you know, as an artist, every day she would wake up excited to make some beautiful piece of art. And she would be like, you know, every day in our household, we were encouraged to sort of wake up and understand and create. And I think that was, you know, far more influential in who I became than my schooling.
That you, it, over the years, I mean, you've gone from you've really kind of grown from the beginnings of your lens printer and creating something new. You created this thing into the electronic rope. Your company, what was it, Squid Labs, that you created.
Yep.
And the rest, and the wind farm company, Makani's, that you helped create, which we'll talk a bit about. But I'm curious, amongst all that and all these kind of creations that you've been involved in, what do you think are the ones that right now speak to you as most plausible to changing the human condition, to affecting issues like climate change?
You know, in some respects, the answer to that is always what I'm working on tomorrow. And the joke, well, it's sort of semi-serious, but I think if you expected every single thing you ever did to affect the human condition and to work, A, you'd be arrogant and no one would ask you to the dinner party, and B, you'd be wrong. And in some sense, I think the job of you know, creatives, whether they're artists or musicians or engineers or inventors, is to just create a whole lot of new options. You know, and then let the world figure out which ones are going to be useful and which ones aren't. I think if you get too hung up on this is the answer to everything, you're bound for disappointment. You know, then I guess the second sort of answer to your question is, you know, I think what we started at Makani and doing higher altitude wind farms,
yeah,
is going to be, you know, it may take a decade. You know, big technologies like that take a long time to reach market, but that will have a big impact. And then, you know, at the moment I'm working on a lot of other energy projects, and I think they're all important. You know, there's not going to be one single easy technological invented fix for the, you know, you call the climate change problem. I really look at it as an energy problem. You know, climate change is the artifact of the way we produce and use energy. And, you know, we need hundreds, if not thousands, of little solutions. Everything from making diapers in a way that uses less energy to making wind-powered electricity cheaper, to making cheaper solar cells, to electric cars. And so, yeah, tomorrow and every day after tomorrow, you know, I'm going to be working on one of those things.
I want to ask you a question about Makani, to describe to our viewers and listeners, but also before we jump into this whole issue of energy, the energy problem, which I think is really key to talk about, the difficulties we face and why we face them and how we can overcome them. But describe what you, the company you created, Makani, and this incredible idea about how to generate wind power. I think it was also your partner. You partnered with Google on that. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah. Google has helped us a lot on that. And so the wind power is one of the, it's after solar power, it's the second largest source of renewable energy in the natural environment. And existing wind turbines are actually excellent. They're fabulous machines, and it's pretty hard to imagine how you make them radically cheaper than we do today. And the reality is we need to make radically cheap wind power if you want to get it to sort of economically to parity with coal. And so, I and a few of my other friends, we were all avid kite surfers and sort of amateur aerodynamicists and energy geeks, and we sort of realized that you could essentially use kites. I mean, they don't resemble the little kite that you buy in the store and fly in the park, but use something that flies on the end of a piece of string to reach the wind that's higher up in the sky. And the wind, as you get higher and higher, it blows stronger and more often. So there's more power available. And so really the idea, to paint a picture for your listeners, is to fly very large kites. We're talking 50-seat wingspans and larger, and to fly them at high speeds in the sky at a couple of thousand feet, and to generate the electricity on those wings and then bring the electricity back down to ground. And so far, it's all going very well, and it really does look like that's a pathway to make wind-powered electricity cost half of what it does today, or do even better than that.
And this is something, in terms of engineering, is possible to do on a large scale.
It's absolutely possible. So we're already doing it on small scales and flying sort of, 10 to 15 seat wingspan kites and generating kilowatts of power, enough to power multiple houses. But the real scale you want to do it on is more like, the size of the smaller industrial aircraft that we fly on. And at that scale, you start to produce megawatts of electricity, or enough to power thousands of houses with each machine. And there's no real technical barrier to doing it at this point. It's really a question of, will the economics prove out well? And then will, one of the questions, Marx, is will society accept these machines? There's a lot of, doesn't matter what energy technology you generate, people seem to complain about having them near their backyards.
Always.
It doesn't matter if it's a coal plant, a nuclear plant, a wind farm, or a solar farm. So the issues, and I think this is true of a lot of the energy issues, the issues aren't technological. We have all, we pretty much have all the technology we need, and a lot of the issues are political and social and economic more than they are technical.
And they are economic in many ways. I mean, one of the things that I think, because clear in reading about your work, is that what it seems is, if you confronted, as you develop these new technologies and work in these new technologies and new ways of generating energy that's non-fossil fuel based, is that it's so cheap to burn oil, gas, and coal. And cheaper now than it was even when we first got panicked about, that people don't want to invest or put money into long-term possibilities, because venture capitalists want their money back next year, not in 10 years.
Yeah, it's, I guess there's a couple of comments there. If you think about what you're competing against, and if you're generating electricity, you're really competing against coal, because oil we use for driving cars and transport principally. But think about the business model for coal. Take a huge truck and you back it up against the mountain. You scrape the mountain into the back of the truck, and then you dump that in a furnace and heat it. It's a pretty amazingly cheap thing to do.
Cheap and destructive, both, but it works.
But it works. It works. Right. You know, in some respects, it works brilliantly, and it's fantastic, and it provides us with, let's be honest, we all have pretty good lifestyles here. You know, everyone might be depressed about the economy, but you'd only have to think back even only 50 years, and actually what this enables you to do is amazing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so the challenge for all these renewables is you've got to beat that, the economics of doing that. And then the reality of developing this type of technology, it's not like you're starting Facebook or Google where it's reasonably cheap to get started because you're just writing software, and then you know pretty quickly whether or not it's working because your distribution is the internet and lots of people look at it, and then you can build a company quickly and start to make a lot of money. It's different with all of these energy things because you've got to build actual machines, and not just little machines, but huge, expensive machines. And then you've got to prove that those machines work reliably, and then you've got to solve all the political and social and economic problems. And, you know, to really take one of these energy generation technologies from an idea to something that's selling electricity to your utility, who in turn is selling it to you as a consumer, you know, that's a... it's multiple hundreds of millions of dollars for each one of those technologies at a minimum. And so that's, and it takes, you know, it takes decades, not 1 or 2 years. And so that's sort of the challenge broadly for getting this new energy economy to happen is we're struggling to find the mechanisms to finance those endeavors because, the capital mechanisms we have, like venture capital, even to venture capital, $100 million is a very, very large number to be risking. And then to have to wait 10 years before you know whether you're going to get that $100 million back is a pretty risky thing. So it's really it's a challenge exactly like what you said. How do we invest in this future at the scale of investment required to really meet the challenge?
It is huge because if it's going to be done, As you indicated, this is a 20-30-year process to turn a fossil fuel based economy around to renewables. It's going to take a long time to transition people's jobs, skills, and build the technology to make it happen.
And you know what's funny? You know, I don't know any engineer that doesn't believe. You know, all the engineers I know, they believe they can do it. They're like, in some respects, there are more engineers wanting to work on this problem than money to pay them to work on it.
Uh-huh.
And they all believe they can do it, and they all want to get it done fast. And it's kind of like on the engineers I know, it's like, yeah, when can we get started? This is going to be the best century ever. There's so many exciting things to build and get done, and we're going to make a better future. And the gating item is getting them the resources to be able to do that job.
One of the things that when you talk about energy and the whole idea of the energy problem, which is really a problem of technology and how you develop something, I was shocked when I realized that it was in the New Yorker article about you that the internet energy and carbon footprint is now exceeds what that footprint would be for air travel, which is huge.
So I think they're about equivalent, and it depends on who's measuring it, but both of those things, so all of the air travel is 2 or 3% of the energy we use, and all of the internet and computing infrastructure is 2 or 3% of the energy we all use. But air travel is not increasing very quickly, and the internet is.
Is.
But in reality, that could be a very good news story.
Why is that?
You know, the internet means that you don't have to fly because you can video conference. you don't have to drive to the video store 5 miles each way in your car to pick up the VHS tape because you can just get it from Netflix. So it sounds shocking, but actually that might be a really good news story. I mean, the internet enables a lot of efficient things to happen.
So how do you then talk a bit about your idea about the energy problem? How do you put your hands around that, and what's the engineering battle and technical struggles to kind of create and address that, not to create but to address that issue?
So to answer your first part of your question, you know, how do you get your head around it? For me, I sort of was already familiar with the problem, and I'd looked at, you know, the big type of statistics you see in boring publications that I hope your audience hasn't had to read, like the International Energy Agency's semi-annual report.
I'm glad you're doing it for us.
Yeah. Oh, actually, you know what? Every one of your readers, your listeners, should go out and read that.
They should. I was being facetious.
Because it is actually important to understand these things. But, you know, what really helped me get my head around it was navel-gazing. I decided to look at and measure how much energy every single aspect of my life used and where that energy came from. And so, you know, I measured the energy of all the flying I did, all the driving I did, even the energy of all the eating and where all my food comes from, the energy in all of the products that I buy, because there's this thing called embodied energy, which is, you know, the amount of energy it took to make the disposable cup that you're getting your Starbucks in that day, the amount of energy it takes to build your cars and make your house and make your washing machine. And then, you know, when I looked at that entire energy picture of my life, it kind of shocked me a little. One thing is that I found out that when I did the measurement the first time around, I used more than or close to double the amount of energy of the average American.
Wow.
So here I was claiming I was an environmentalist working on wind power and saving the world, but, you know, in some respects I was like, wow, I am the hypocrite. I am the problem. So that was a little shocking, and it sort of really made me start to think, you know, there's two sides to the problem. You've got to completely transform the way we generate energy today, which is switch all the coal and the nuclear all the coal and the natural gas and the oil to some other renewable form or nuclear form. But then also, you know, if everyone in the world used as much energy as I, Saul Griffith, used, we'd have to produce close to 7 or 8 times the amount of energy that we do today. And then you're like, well, actually, that's probably, if you then look at the numbers for the planet, it's like, that's actually pretty unlikely that we're going to be able to do that. So that sort of made me start to think a lot more about how we use energy, and in some respects, the question, how do I keep living a lifestyle that I really want to live, but reduce my personal energy consumption by, you know, a factor of 5 or more.
So that's part of your project, What's On, isn't that correct? Is that what that is called, that you're working on?
Yeah, we started a project, What's On, that was sort of based on the initial calculations that I did for myself, and then we generalized it and made it into a tool on the web. And it's like it's analogous to a carbon calculator, except instead of measuring carbon, we measure your energy or your power consumption. And the name What's On is because the watt is a unit of power, and that unit of power, the watt is actually how many joules of energy you use every second of your life.
Hmm.
So we made that tool available, and lots of people have used that to get a sense of their energy use.
Uh-huh.
That's really just a public education kind of awareness tool. Now it's really about, well, how do you make all of the insight that you get from doing that actionable? How do we actually now make the real changes to our own lives to make a difference? And then that's where I spend a lot of my time today is looking at all the places I use too much energy and figuring out how to do the thing that I wanted, that I was using that energy for, but do it using a lot less energy.
It would be fun to for us to, with our listeners and viewers and on our webpage, to kind of take that test ourselves and see what everybody thinks.
Yeah, absolutely. I think everyone learns a lot, and the more information you give it and the more detail you go into, the more you learn. And, you know, you find out some really crazy stuff. Like, you know, there's this emphasis on switch your light bulbs to compact fluorescence or LED lighting.
Right.
I'm definitely not going to say that's not a good thing to do. That's a fabulous thing to do. But actually, my newspaper subscriptions were using more energy than all the electric light in my life. So in some significant sense, canceling my subscription to the New York Times was more important than Huh. I've been changing all my light bulbs.
So how do you, then where do you get your news?
So, you know, now I get it on a Kindle or an iPad or on my computer. That's that example where the internet enables you to uh-huh. In the sustainability community, they call that term dematerialization.
Dematerialization. It would take me a leap to. That's a real struggle. That would be a struggle for me to give up my New York Times subscription. I'd have to wrestle with that one.
Well, this brings up a great point. We used to get the New York Times, I think, 4 days a week.
Right.
And then I showed my wife this, and I was like, look, you know, we could really make a big difference here. And we negotiated down to just 1 day a week. So we get it on Sunday. She's like, over my dead body. I'll give up nearly everything else. I'll turn the thermostat down. Just don't take my Sunday Times away.
I'm with your wife right now. I'm sorry, but
I think that's a really illustrative and really important story and lesson. Mm-hmm. And you know, I guess I'm on the cutting edge of this because I've been doing all these numbers and looking at it. And what you start to realize that this energy and climate change game, it's a quality of life issue. And if you think about it correctly, you're like, well, actually, you know. If I'm going to prioritize the things that I do, I'm going to make decisions in a very different way about how to lower my energy consumption. And for my wife, she's like, "Well, if you want, I'll walk to the corner store every day as long as I can keep my New York Times." And I think in some respects, you know, that's what we're facing globally is that same question. It's not, you know, whether we all get the New York Times, but it's like, what do we want the future to look like, and what do we want our lifestyles to look like, and what do we want our quality of life to be? And the quality of life includes, you know, what temperature do we want the planet to be at?
There's a quote on your page, on your About page, and I want to read it to you and ask you, kind of the kind of closing thought with this. He said, it's written there, it's becoming clear that our lifestyles have become unsustainable and that fossil fuel scarcity and global climate change are threatening to cause economic and environmental damage to the world. Any solution to this problem will need to include a collective effort by all of us to reduce the amount of energy we are using in our lives. And I add to that, it seems to me that in some ways, you're also saying we're not going to invent our way out of this environmental and energy dilemma that we face unless we change the way we do business. So I'm curious about how you think that, what that means in a larger sense for society, and are you optimistic we're going to be able to do that? Because we can change our footprint, but we got to change our industrial footprint as well.
I think this is the crux of the issue. You can't do it without technology, right? We're going to have to use a whole bunch of new technologies. Some of them you've already heard of, the solar panels and the wind turbines and everything. We're going to need to do all of that, and that's just to change the existing energy infrastructure. But if you look at the numbers globally and the big social picture, right? So the average American uses more than 5 times the amount of energy the average Chinese person does and close to 10 times the amount of energy of the average Indian person. Then you remember that there's 300 million Americans and there's about a billion of those each of Chinese and Indians. They want a lifestyle that looks more like ours, right? And it's going to be pretty hard to convince them that they don't get to have a better lifestyle than they have today.
Right.
And so then that really, I do think, forces you to think about, well, how do we all get that lifestyle that's better than the one we do today, but we lower the amount of energy that it takes us all to do it, because we're simply not going to be able to make this magic quantity of energy that everyone can go and live the life of a wealthy American. And, you know, that 7 billion of those lifestyles don't add up the way we do business today. So
right.
It really does mean you've got to change nearly, you know, you can look at everything we do, and there's opportunities to change and make more efficient and lower the energy use of everything we do, whether it be changing your light bulbs or riding your bicycle to work or, you know, canceling Monday through Saturday of your New York Times subscription or whatever it is. You know, it's all those things. Eating meat less often is a really big factor. Flying less often, you know, so I'm not saying don't go and see your family at Christmas. That's probably the flying trip that you want to keep, but it's finding a way to make your business flights not have to happen because you learn how to video conference instead.
So in all that, I'm curious where you've come to for yourself, where Saul Griffith has come to in terms of your view of where our future is going. It's obviously critical, but it's obviously very difficult for us to make this transition in our societies. I'm curious what you think is, not that you're prescient or anything, but what you think is, what you think about where we're going and whether you've become more optimistic or pessimistic about what our chances are to get there.
It's a really interesting question. I'm going to try and dodge the question and see whether you can figure out that I'm doing that.
All right, go ahead.
If you really look at the numbers, it's extremely easy to be depressed. And we've got a huge amount of work to do, and we're nowhere near on track, and there's no inclination that we will get on track. So that's one way to look at it. And in my dark moments, that's my perspective.
Right.
But I had my first child 18 months ago. And when I wake up in the morning, well, actually, when he wakes me up in the morning, I look at him and I think about the future and I was like, there's no way we're not going to solve this problem. We have to solve this problem. And so it might be hard, it might be whatever it is, but you know, we're actually all going to have a ball solving this problem. It's going to be one of the most engaged centuries humanity has ever participated in collectively. Because we're all going to be on, you know, in my optimistic moments, we're all going to be on target. We're all going to be working towards doing this and we're all going to be doing it so that our future and our children's futures are better, right? And I'd encourage a lot more people to think of it like that, because otherwise it's too easy to be distressed. And distress doesn't get you anywhere. This, you know, and I like the engineer's optimistic approach. You know, we'll do it. We'll fix it. Let's just get started. And, you know, I think there's a lot of reasons to believe the future could be way more beautiful than the past. And, you know, maybe to give you an idea of that, you know, if my, you know, I went to school on a dirty old school bus, and school buses are not terribly efficient, and they burn fossil fuels. It would be much more efficient to catch a roller coaster to school or a zip line to school. Roller coasters and zip lines are two of the most efficient forms of transportation we've ever invented. And you know what? I'm pretty sure I can convince every 8-year-old listening that you have that in a future where we're catching roller coasters and zip lines to school, the future is way better than today. And I think that's how we got to look at it. Look at all of the opportunities here to actually make the world cooler and better. And we're going to have more market gardens, and there's going to be more parks in cities, and we're going to do better urban design, and there'll be better transit systems. And we've got to keep that vision in mind. Otherwise, we're just all going to get depressed and sit on our hands.
Saul Griffith, this has been a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking time with us all.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
Take care. That was inventor Saul Griffith speaking with us for one of our Urbanite radio stories. And now we're going to take a very short break, but before we do, I want to remind you all to join us at the Annapolis Summit next week, Wednesday, January the 12th. I'll be at the Calvert House in Annapolis with Governor Martin O'Malley, Senate President Mike Miller, and House Speaker Michael Bush discussing their priorities for the upcoming legislative session. Don't miss your chance to ask our elected officials about the issues that are important to you. And to do that, email summit@steinershow.org or call 410-454-0500 for information on how to reserve your seat. You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away, because when we come back from this very brief break, we're going to hear a story about young people speaking out for peace on the Gaza Strip. Stay with us. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555.